There we go. All right, back on the right.
Force of habit.
Okay, so now let's talk about the CDS collateral calls generally, but probably focusing on Goldman, since at least they were the first, the biggest. So again, you've talked about before, I think in the third quarter of 07 ballpark, you learned about the initial collateral call, is that correct?
Yes, so that's my recollection, that's right.
Okay, so if you could describe for us just generally what your involvement is from 3Q07 or whenever you learn about it until you leave in October of 08, in the collateral call dispute process, in the first instance with Goldman, and then two, just generally with all the counterparties.
Okay. I generally did not have a direct role in the collateral, if you want to call it dispute process or collateral resolution process of it, whichever way you want to approach it. I mean, that was principally handled through AIG Financial Products. Bill Dooley and his team got involved in it as time marched along. Risk management got involved with it to a certain extent as well, in helping to try to evaluate the differences of opinion in collateral requests and what the FP models were, or FP analysis would indicate. I had, to the best of my recollection, my direct involvement was only limited to a couple of phone calls that I had, and I don't remember the exact time frames, but I had one or two phone calls since I had been the treasurer of the company earlier in my career. As I said, with AIG, I had still had strong relationships with a lot of our bank counterparts, and one of them was Calion, the French bank, and I remember the relationship manager of Calion calling me and just saying, hey, you know, we're having some, I don't remember the time frame of this at all. I don't remember if it was late 07 or early 2000, I just can't recall. But, you know, just asked me if I would make sure that you know, the other side of the house in our organization, FP, knew, you know, about the relationship that, you know, we had corporately with Calion and all the different areas. And, you know, so it was more of that kind of, you know, just help us if you can, make sure these guys are focusing us as an important counterparty. So there was that couple of conversations, and that was it. And all that's what I did. You know, I just made sure that Bill Dooley and Joe Cassano and those guys knew Calion was a more pervasive counterparty for us in the organization in terms of banking services and things like that. As far as Goldman goes, I had one or perhaps two, and I can't recall, very short conversations with David Vinier of Goldman Sachs, who's their CFO, I believe it was January of 2008. Could have been February too, but they were the most significant collateral difference at that point in time among all the counterparties. And I called him just to sort of principally trying to set some protocol, to try to help set some protocol, because our the team on our side was saying that they were difficult and they weren't providing a lot of transparency around how they're coming up with their valuations, and they thought their valuations were completely wrong, and that it was a cash grab. That's the term I remember them using, and that it really was different from reality. So I called Vinier mainly to see if, you know, they could be more cooperative, because this is what I was getting from my people in terms of transparency and meeting and making their people more available to have these discussions. And that's what I think. I mean, that's what I recall about my direct involvement. Otherwise, I really didn't have any.
Okay, so when you have these one to two phone calls with Mr. V, Vinier. Is that how you pronounce it, Vinier?
Yeah, probably so.
I'm mispronouncing it all this time.
That's how I pronounce it.
Have you been mispronouncing it all this time? I doubt
Maybe.
It. I'm sure it's me. But when you have these phone calls and you tell him, or words to the effect, look, my guys don't think your marks are right, can you be more cooperative? What is his general response?
His response?
His general response. What's the specific response?
What I remember him saying to me, and it's the only substantive part of the conversation, is that they think that our guys are, I think he used the term, off the wall in their marks. And I said, well, they think the same of yours. And, what makes you think that? He says, well, I don't think they're being realistic about the market and the conditions and this and that. And I conveyed that information, their point of view through him into our process. And I also mentioned it to PwC, that's what he said. And I said, well, we have to come to grips with it. And, this is obviously their point of view, and we have to somehow, between now and the end of February, when we have to produce our 10K, we're going to have to figure out how we factor all of this disruption in the market and people's differing point of views and counterparties and, all of that into the valuation process. And ultimately, we develop an approach that we used for the valuation as of December 31st for the 10K that took, all sorts of inputs into account. It took the BET model with the new inputs was part of it, but part of it was pricing from collateral managers and from other counterparties and all of the different collateral calls that were being asked for, and as much as we could know about those were informing the process. And, the ultimate sort of valuation model that was used at December 31st, and I believe thereafter, was really sort of a hybrid of a lot of different inputs that were either available or not available, and trying to make sense out of a highly disrupted market.
Okay, I'll tell you that from the documents we've seen, I think the first collateral call from Goldman comes in on July 26, 2007. Mm-hmm. Is that consistent with your recollection about when you first hear about collateral calls?
No, I heard about it much later than that, to the best of my recollection.
And what is much later?
Again, during my recollection is during the third quarter closing process, which would have been after September 30th.
Okay. So the documents we've seen indicate that I think AIG posts about $450 million of collateral in August. I take it, did you know that at that time?
I don't recall.
Okay.
It's possible. I don't recall.
Sure. On November 23rd, certainly after you become aware of the situation in general, I believe AIG FP posts another $1.5 billion of collateral, and I think the amount of posting stays at that $2 billion ballpark level through the end of the year. Did you know that?
I wouldn't have recalled the specific number.
Generally.
But I recall that there was more collateral posted to Goldman. I just wouldn't have remembered the amount.
Okay. And do you recall whether or not AIG FP thought that they at least had an obligation to post that amount?
I don't recall what their view of that was.
Do you recall whether or not Goldman thought that amount was sufficient?
No, I don't.
Okay, I will tell you that, from documents we've seen, while $450 million is posted in August, it's up to $2 billion on November 23rd and stays at $2 billion by the end of the year. Goldman does not think that is sufficient. And in fact, the two companies enter into a written agreement saying we all dispute, that what the margin posting should be.
Right.
Me giving you that information, does that jog memory bells about knowing that there were still disputes on both sides about the amount of collateral that should be posted?
Yeah, not specifically in terms of a time frame.
But generally you knew in the November-December time frame that there were disputes with Goldman about the amount of collateral that was posted?
Yes.
Okay. During the December 5th, 2007 conference call, an analyst asks about a disclosure in the third quarter 2007 Q. I think it's a guy named Gates from Credit Suisse. And it was that disclosure in the Q that said, we do have differences with our counterparties, or words to that effect, on collateral calls. And Mr. Cassano responds, you know, look, when we tell them that we disagree with their marks, they go away. Do you remember that statement there in that conference call?
I vaguely remember him saying something like that as part of an answer, but I don't remember what the rest of the answer was.
Did you recall having any discussions with Mr. Cassano or anyone else about that, given the fact that Cody Goldman was not going away?
No, I don't.
Do you call ever having any discussions about correcting that statement publicly?
No, I don't.
So the collateral disputes between Goldman and AIG, other than the January 2008 one or two phone calls with Mr. Vinier, that's the extent of your involvement with Goldman?
Yes.
Okay. And you mentioned that you had, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you had a conversation with the relationship manager at Calion.
And I think, you know, somebody else in his organization. That's what I can't remember who it was.
Okay. Who's the person at AIG, whether it's AIG, whether it's financial services, or whether it's FP, who's the point person there dealing with the Goldman collateral calls, if you know?
I don't know specifically.
Okay, so to use the vernacular for us lawyers, the person most knowledgeable about collateral disputes for Goldman, you don't know who that person would be within the AIG family of companies?
I just don't recall who was sort of running point on that, no.
Okay, from the discussions you've had at the time with folks, I mean, was Dooley involved? Was Cassano involved? Was Habayeb? I know I butchered his name, I'm sorry. How about Ebb involved? Frost? Forster? I mean, does any...
Some combination of some of those or all of those. I don't know who was... I don't remember who was having direct conversations. I just don't...
Who was responsible for trying to value, I guess, the contracts to determine what kind of collateral should be posted at AIG? And when I say AIG, I mean, you know, FP and financial services and all that, if you know.
Well, to the best of my recollection, it was principally the AIG FP folks in, you know, with oversight from both risk management and from Bill Dooley and his group.
And are they using, again, I don't know why I keep prefacing with if you know, but I do, are they using the same bet model in terms of trying to, you know, value it or dispute Goldman's marks?
I'm just not sure.
Sure. When, in any conversations you had with Mr. Vinier, did he explain how Goldman was arriving at their marks?
No.
Did you ask him how he was arriving at their marks?
I don't think he was really an expert in how they were arriving at their marks. I mean, our conversation was a completely different level.
Okay, but that didn't answer my question. I understand that, but did you ask him how they were coming up with their marks?
I don't think it was germane to the conversation. I don't recall asking him that.
Okay. Did you have discussions with anybody within AIG who told you how Goldman was supposedly coming up with their marks?
This is what we were trying to find out, and this is where, you know, they never felt that they had good transparency around that. And they also, I recall them being FP in particular, saying, you know, that they thought Goldman was inconsistent with most of the rest of the market. And I remember them showing us some data, and I don't remember the time frame, but on, you know, where different counterparties were involved in the same credit default obligation or the same credit default swap, where, you know, different counterparties were giving very different types of pricing indications, and Goldman was almost always the lowest, sometimes significantly, in terms of their valuation. So this was one of the reasons. Again, you know, remember, this was a highly disrupted, illiquid, very, you know, non-transparent kind of a market at this point in time. So you're dealing with the best information you can get. But, you know, my recollection is that they you know, they showed quotes from different dealers on the same type or either the same security or the same type of security that where Goldman was always much lower.
And when you say these are the folks from FP?
Yes.
Okay. Who were the other counterparties that were after Goldman? What was there a counterparty that stood out as having, you know, difficult marks, I guess is the phrase I'll use.
Most of the conversations were around that were around Goldman. I don't recall others standing out. There may have been, I just don't recall it.
Did there ever come a time while you were at AIG where there wasn't a dispute with Goldman about the amount of collateral that should be posted? And what I'm getting at, did events just sort of overtake everything as you got into the fall of 2008 and the issue was just you've got a liquidity crisis here? And
yeah, I mean, I just can't remember that.
Did you?
Sure. My name is Donna Norman. I'm not sure if this will refresh your recollection at all, but we have an indication that on November 6th of 07, you informed the board, and this may be the AIGFP board, I'm not sure, since you had a dual reporting, but I know that the director of it was there. But you informed the board at that time that five counterparties had made collateral calls on AIG and that $450 million had been posted to Goldman.
Yeah.
So that, hopefully that refreshes your recollection a little bit that you had some involvement.
Well, no, remember I said that I became aware of the collateral calls during the third quarter closing process, so that timing would coincide.
Okay. To follow up on Chris's questions, so if November 6th of 07 you were talking to the board about collateral, I mean, did you stay involved? Did you ask FP to give you ongoing reports as to when they posted collateral, when collateral calls were coming in?
My recollection is that I asked Bill Dooley and his team and Bob Lewis and his team to stay on top of it, but, you know, there were a lot of other things going on. I couldn't do that on my own.
So you have no recollection of, I think Chris already asked you, no recollection of knowing when that increased to $2 billion?
I just don't remember.
Okay. And do you have Pierre Macias drafted an internal memo dated December 20th?
Okay.
Specifically on the Goldman Sachs collateral dispute, which gave some detail to Goldman's marking process, and in fact described it as simple and objective, albeit he thought wrong. And then it went on to describe AIGFP's preferred method of marking the portfolio. Did you see that memo?
I don't remember it all.
Do you remember any discussion that Macias had come up with a valuation and had participated in multiple conference calls with Goldman?
I don't remember specifically.
Their evaluation process?
No.
And do you specifically remember, I think you, when you spoke about your January-February calls with Mr. Vigneur, you spoke about that being before a reporting period. Do you specifically recall that being in the February time period, January-February?
No, that's the best of my recollection.
The reason I asked is because we do have internal emails, which are Goldman Sachs emails,
right.
Which reference you having conversations with David Vigneur once on March 24th and again in early April.
Okay, so maybe I was wrong.
That's the evidence I have.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
They were discussing internally calls that Vigneur had with you. So I was just checking the dates.
I told you it was a continuum.
Sure.
I don't remember the
exact
time frame.
I'm assuming those calls did take place, but I'm just wondering if that triggers your memories, if there were two sets of calls or if that perhaps was the only set of calls.
I don't remember any other sets of calls, so I don't know if that's accurate or not, so I'm sorry.
Okay.
Does it help? I mean, we know that the fourth quarter 2007 earnings call is February 28th. Does that help if perhaps there were, in addition to the calls reflected in these emails in the March-April time frame, that there still could have been calls in January, February. In fact, do you remember if they were before the earnings call or before the 8K disclosure?
Yeah, I thought they were, but maybe they weren't. And
could have been both.
It's not impossible, Chris, but I don't remember having that many calls with David Vineyard.
Okay.
The other thing that's reflected in the goal emails were that that you had instigated a call to Mr. Vineyard, and again in the March 24th, 25th time period,
yeah,
and that the collateral posted at that point by from AIG to Goldman was $3 billion, and it reflected a suggestion by you to Mr. Vineyard that AIG going forward continue to post half of the collateral that Goldman called for. Do you recall discussion of any sort of gentleman's agreement that you would have, you would post half of the collateral?
I don't remember.
Do you recall in those conversations with Mr. Vineyard or anyone else from Goldman or internally at AIG, any discussion of the specific negotiating, how you would come to terms in negotiating?
I'm sorry, I don't remember.
So you don't remember that in March. Was there ever a time period that it was escalated to the point that the numbers were getting so high that the collateral posted that you felt you needed to get more involved prior to your departure?
Well, I was made aware of the status of the collateral calls, and we had set up a process, as I had mentioned, where, you know, I specifically said, you know, Bob Lewis, you and your team, and along with Bill Dewey, you and your team, have to be very much on top of what the FB folks are doing with regard to collateral calls and take control of that process. I don't remember when exactly that time frame was.
Was there a period prior to your departure in October that you felt you needed to be more personally involved as opposed to delegating that down to Bob Lewis and Mr. Dewey?
I just don't recall. No, I mean, there was a lot going on during that time frame, and, you know, there's only so much one person could do. I mean, you have a knowledgeable expert staff. I mean, they were much more knowledgeable and expert in these areas than I was.
Was there a point when you recall them coming to you and saying, we've got real liquidity issues, or this is a capital issue?
Well, we, I mean,
specifically vis-a-vis the collateral call.
I don't recall.
Okay, so let's try to. I got two more areas I want to talk with you about.
Okay,
and I'll try to wrap up quick if any of you guys want to catch a train. Office of Thrift Supervision. Did you
right.
deal with them much at all?
I dealt with them, yes.
Okay. When did the OTS first raise concerns with you about the CDS portfolio?
Chris, I can't remember the time frame, but to the best of my recollection, it was later in the process. It wasn't before the issues were manifesting themselves. It was after. That's the best of my recollection.
Did you interact with the OTS examiners during either regular examinations or targeted examinations? Do you know what I mean by regular and targeted?
Yeah.
More or less, anyway.
We would have, to the best of my recollection, my interactions with them generally occurred during, you know, senior management update meetings with them, which occurred, I'm not even sure it was quarterly. It may have been quarterly, or it may have been less than, with less frequency than quarterly. I don't remember the exact time frame, but I was not generally one of the principal people dealing with them on a day-to-day basis.
And who were the OTS people that you dealt with on less than a day-to-day basis?
I would have to see, I mean, I'd have to see their names to remember.
But were they on-site examiner type folk, or were they in Washington, D.C. type folk? Or
I think it was both.
Okay. Maybe this will help jog some memory bells. They send a letter in March of 08 downgrading you guys from a 2 to a 3 on a composite rating basis.
Yeah.
Is
When do you recall that letter and downgrade in that general March timeframe of 08?
I wouldn't have remembered the time frame. I remember the downgrade.
Is that downgrade the time when the OTS first, in your mind, raises concerns about the CDS portfolio, or had they been raised earlier?
As I said, it's hard for me to remember. But to the best of my recollection, it was already when things were, you know, clearly manifesting themselves. That, you know, we had, you know, that these issues were becoming, you know, more significant. So I don't remember the exact time frame, but I don't recall it being sort of an early warning indicator.
Okay. Do you remember whether or not they were expressing concerns with the portfolio before the Coleman collateral call came in?
I don't remember.
Do you recall if they were expressing concerns when AIG was in the process of developing the BET model?
No, I don't remember that.
Okay. Do you recall if they expressed concerns before the discovery in January 08 of the $3.6 billion adjustment and that eventually leads to the 8K?
I do not.
Okay. Do you recall the OTS ever expressing concerns about the securities lending portfolio?
I do not recall, no.
Okay. Did you know that in this time frame, supervision by the OTS is transferred from D.C. to folks up in the Northeast region? Did you know that?
I remember some reorganization that they had and changing responsibilities, but I don't remember. I wouldn't have remembered. I don't remember whom and what offices. No.
That probably answers my next question. Did anybody ever tell you why they did that reorganization, as you termed it?
Not that I recall.
Can you describe for me generally how the compensation program worked at AIG parent, and if there was a separate program for FP, how it worked? And of course, with my usual caveat, if you know.
Well, I can answer it sort of generally. Over what time frame?
Oh, the time frame that you're CFO.
Okay, so there were, let's talk about AIG for
sure.
A second. AIG had an interesting array of compensation programs in place prior to the time that Martin and I were promoted into our new positions in March of 2005. It was a combination of obviously base salary, of what I would call nominal kinds of annual cash bonuses, at least for people at my level, it was pretty nominal. They called them sprinkles. And they weren't particularly large compared to what you would normally see. But then they had, there were also stock options in the company that were provided, and they weren't typically overly significant in the scheme of things. But then they had two other vehicles, and this is where it became, you know, relatively unique. They had Star International, SECO, which was a deferred equity compensation plan, and effectively you got, again, I don't remember all the details of the SECO plan, it's a while ago, but as a participant in SECO, you had, depending on what your status was, you had different share, you know, potential share levels of SECO, and most of that was deferred until you were, I think, 65 or retired from the company. It was really, really long-term golden handcuff kind of stuff, and there were some early payouts that were made and some earlier liquidity, but most of it was really deferred. And then there was CV Star, and they had something called CV Star Partners, and this was I think the group in SECO was, I'm using very round numbers and I could be off, but maybe 700 people in the organization, and out of, you know, 100,000 plus, so it was a limited, you know, less than 1% of the organization. And in CV Star, I think there were under 100 people, maybe 70-ish, so it was really the most elite program to be in, and that was a different kind of a program where you actually had to make a contribution to buy into it. It wasn't a big contribution, and then you know, depending on your level, it was also deferred compensation, totally separate from CEGO. And I don't remember now the workings of those programs. I was relatively new to the organization, so I didn't really have much of a of an involvement in those, although I was, I think in 2004, early 2004, made a star partner, and I was at CECO from the beginning of my employment. When the change occurred...
the 05 change, you mean?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Subsequent to that, it was clear because of the separation, and when Hank Greenberg completely separated from the company, later in 2005, it was clear that, you know, those vehicles were no longer, it was contentious, and those vehicles were no longer going to be in existence, so the company had to redesign its compensation plans. And I remember that Martin and many others at senior management, who had been with the company for many, many, many years, wanted to be sure that the new programs had, you know, weren't so abruptly different than the older program. So, you know, the thought was to sort of emulate some of those programs in something that was defined. One is this, the partners plan was the successor to CECO, and then the senior partners plan was the successor to CV Star. And, you know, again, this was done principally with human resources and, you know, and through, of course, the compensation committee. These new plans were designed and implemented sometime during the course of 2005, and I think there might have been a transition year of 2005 to 2006. It's a long time ago. It's hard to remember specifically. So the new version of the AIG compensation plan included base salary, I'd say a larger potential annual bonus based upon company and individual performance, and then these other plans. The partners plan was a deferred equity plan, and the senior partners plan was a deferred cash compensation plan. FP.
Let me stop you for a
minute. Okay.
So let's focus on AIG and then we'll move to
FP. But I wouldn't call myself the expert in this area.
No, I understand. You certainly knew, I assume, what was going on with your comp, right?
In that regard.
Right.
I've never worked for a company with stock options. Maybe someday. But anyway, so explain to me, after Greenberg leaves and the program that's in place from March 05 or ballpark forward. Certainly, I assume for 2005 bonus and stock grant purposes at the end of the year. So the cash bonus, that's deferred comp?
No. There were two elements. One was an annual cash bonus that was made the following spring, sometime March or whatever it was. I don't remember the exact time frame. And then the senior partners plan was also a cash plan. That was deferred.
Okay. And then the stock portion of the compensation.
Right.
Was that just straight stock options with the exercise price being the market price at the date of the grant, assuming there's no
stock
options backdating?
Stock options, no, there's no backdating. Stock options were part of the package, and they were, yes, they were standard stock options with a, I don't remember, 3 to 5 year vesting. I don't remember. It might have been 4. I just don't remember. I think it was changed at some point down the line. And then the senior partners plan, which was a deferred. Oh, I already said that. And then there was the CECO, the partners plan, which was the successor to the CECO plan, which I would characterize as a deferred equity plan. It was restricted stock units, effectively, that were earned. As I recall, I think there were 3-year cycles, and it was largely modeled after what had come before, just, you know, without using those vehicles.
Okay, and were the RSUs, they were just a straight grant at effectively a zero exercise price, right?
Yeah, there was no, they were restricted stock units.
Okay, and then was that a similar vesting, or would you all just get them after after a certain amount of years?
As I said, I think they were in cycles, and okay. I think the cycles ended, my recollection is either 5 or 6 years after the cycle was over. So the idea was to capture you know, potential loss reserve development, because again, most of the company was an insurance organization. AIG Financial Products, to the best of my recollection, was not in those plans. They had their own.
And you mentioned something there that I think goes to my next question. Were there clawback provisions for any of the deferred comp? You know, whether it's based on loss allowances that come or anything else?
Well, to the extent...
What determined whether you'd get it? Was it just the expiration of the
No, it's largely company performance and meeting its performance objectives.
Okay, and we may be talking past each other. So, but let's start there. Uh-huh. In terms of it's the end of the year and everybody's wondering how much stock am I going to get, how much cash bonus am I going to get, whether it's current or deferred, what are the factors that go into what executive compensation is going to be at the end of the year?
Again, the best way to explain it, at least the way I remember it, is that the amount that you received, the number of units you received in the partner's plan, the number of units you received in the senior partner's plan, the number of stock options you received, you know, sort of when you looked at the whole package, it was based upon, you know, the assessment of your individual contribution to the organization. The valuation, ultimately, of what those might be worth was deferred and based upon the results of the company against financial objectives over a longer period of time with long vesting.
So, I get that, the difference between here's what you get, here's what it's worth down the road.
Right.
But in terms of here's what you get, is there a written evaluation at the end of the year that says here's what you get and why?
I don't recall that there were always written for the senior executives. There was certainly communication. I recall Martin sitting down with me and saying, okay, here's, and I don't remember the amount,
sure,
but, you know, here's what you're getting, here's, you know, I think you're doing this kind of a job, and, you know, and,
right,
and here you go.
Other than the executive's contribution to the company, did other things impact compensation, like earnings or stock price appreciation or any other financial metric of the company?
Well, as I said, the value of what you got was predicated.
I understand that, but on what you get, on the grant, I mean, is that impacted at all by any financial metric of the company? I get the financial metric of the company impact valuation.
The only way I can answer that is that I suppose if you're a business leader in a profit center, if your business was not doing well, not meeting expectations, that your manager, whether it's the CEO or whether it's one of the segment heads or, you know, it's a tiered structure, might say, I'm giving you less units than you had last year because you need to improve your performance. I mean, sure, that could be possible.
Okay, and understanding that, you know, the performance of the company is going to impact the value of that deferred comp, and of course the deferred nature of the comp, you know, also impacts that. Were there any clawback provisions in AIG's comp program?
I don't recall any clawback provisions.
Okay. Describe to me, to the extent you know, AIG FP's comp program.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, I've at least read in the financial press, I think I've seen documents yet, about the 30% of revenue bonus plan at FP.
Yeah.
If you know anything about that, I would love
to
hear it.
It's just so long enough ago that I just can't remember the specifics of it. But what I do remember is that I don't believe it involved any AIG stock, and I believe that in general, the FP employees were fully vested in what they had earned, even though I think there were deferrals of the payout, that if they left, you know, one of the odd features I thought of it was that they, you know, that it was going to be paid no matter whether they left the company or stayed, you know, when they were vested in it. So there were some different kinds of features that, you know, were, to me, atypical. But I don't remember the specifics.
And was that deferred comp just deferred cash bonus, or was that AIG stock?
No, I don't believe there was any AIG stock involved. I think it was all cash.
Okay. And is your understanding that while that was deferred, and you wouldn't get it for what, actually, how long was it deferred for?
I don't remember.
Okay. But for example, just so I can try and picture it, if Joe Cassano is going to get a $1 million bonus,
he should be so, right? And we know it was much longer.
Yeah, it's tough here.
Right.
But he's not going to get that until like 3 or 4 years down the road, right?
Yeah.
Or a portion of that until 3 or 4 years
down
the road, I take it,
right?
And then, but nothing impacted whether or not he would get it? I mean, the company could blow up, but he'd still just get it. It was just a matter of waiting for it?
I think there were, I think it was, see, this is where I'm just not sure, but I recall a concept that there was, you know, a pool of this deferred comp that was at risk, and I just don't remember how it was at risk.
Okay.
To absorb losses. So
and I'm sure we have the documents, and we'll look at them.
Yeah.
Just trying to have somebody watch out for
if
me.
If I remember, I would tell you.
So I think I only have one more question, and it's the question I ask everybody at the end of these interviews, whether it comes from a company that met an unfortunate end or a regulator that perhaps maybe did some things that could have been done better. And that is, looking back now, in your mind, what were the mistakes made? What did go wrong? What were the lessons learned from, you know, senior management perspective at AIG?
Well, I have to think about that question for a minute. Well, certainly for me, I think the major lesson to me is a risk management lesson, which is that when you're dealing with financial markets and you're dealing with risk assessments, you know, risk-adjusted assessments and risk factors that you're putting into your financial models to try to quantify risks of things going wrong, that, you know, that the tail, you know, can be a lot fatter than what you might expect, or that, you know, even in extremely stressed scenarios, and that, you know, catastrophic market events or cataclysmic market events can occur, and that you have to take that into account from an overall risk management perspective when you're, you know, designing your risk appetite as a corporation and how much capital and liquidity you hold for that. And I think, you know, the financial markets in general, and this is not just an AIG issue by any means, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the entire financial system was brought to its knees by what happened, because most people, most constituents underestimated, you know, the potential of that tail and of those, you know, extraordinary events and a confluence of events. You know, shutting down, you know, completely shutting down the capital markets, completely shutting down liquidity. I mean, all of the things that happened and coalesced in that, fall of 2008 time frame, I think were just underestimated in general by most market participants. And I think the lesson for me is it can happen, and it's happened.
Other than perhaps more robust risk management to take account of unanticipated tail risk. Anything else in terms of any mistakes made within the company?
Well, I think in retrospect, in hindsight, it all relates to that, because it was all interpreting what the market was telling you and how it was affecting your businesses and what measures you were taking and what the potential exposure was, and, you know, misconstruing the fact that it could get, you know, so much dynamically worse. And I'm not sure you could have actually done much about it, even if you thought it was, but I just don't know. I'm not sure I could tell you much more.
Have you given testimony before related to your responsibilities at AIG?
So depositions, that sort of thing?
Anything.
Well, I'm not sure of the question. I've had some depositions in private litigation, and I've given testimony to the to the government a year ago in connection with their investigations.
It's the SEC.
It was the SEC, the Justice Department, the whole paratape, everybody was there. It was four full days, as I recall.
Can we, can we get a list from counsel on the private litigation so we don't have to pull it out?
You mean depositions that he's given in AIG related litigation? Sure.
Mr. Bensinger, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate you coming in.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Off the record.